Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 280. And I'm joined today by Cariad Lloyd. I was hugely excited to make this one happen. I've been a fan of Cariad and her work in general for a while, but her Griefcast was something, is a podcast I really loved. And the first time I listened to it, I kind of felt that we were kindred spirits of sorts. And as soon as we sat down and chatted, that was confirmed. I'd actually had a briefer chat with Cariad a few weeks before for the upcoming Pod Bible podcast, which the trailer will be up on Monday on iTunes, Acast and Spotify and all good places. And the new Pod Bible magazine's out on Monday as well. But I'll talk about that more in the outro. So yeah, it was great to get to sit down with Cariad. If you enjoy this episode, if this is your first one, cool, we've had loads of good comedians on. We've had Ed Gamble, James Acaster, Sarah Pascoe, Catherine Ryan, Ashlyn B, Nish Kumar. Yeah, loads of good comedians on here, so check them out. I've also had Carla Valentine doing a sex and death special. That was in the first year, because Carla is, she was a mortician, and now she works at Bart's Pathology. So yeah, that's a good one to go and listen to if you've been drawn here by the taboo subject of death. Anyway, I'll get on with the podcast. I obviously need to mention that we're brought to you as ever by speechdevelopmentrecords.com, where you can buy all my merch and stuff. That's something I need to tell you in the intro, actually. It's my birthday on Saturday, and on my birthday, I always release something new. And this year, all the projects I'm working on are too far from completion to release. So what I've done is I've dug through my own personal collection of merch and records and stuff, and on my birthday, I'm going to be putting up Pip's birthday box, which is a selection of stuff that some of it has never been available before. Some of it has been sold out for 5 years. Some of it's been sold out for 5 weeks. Some of them there's one copy. Some of them there's 20 copies. So that'll all be going up in a secret location on August 3rd. I will tweet it and Instagram it and Facebook it so you can get to it via the link. But that's what we're doing for my birthday this year. Anyway, there's also patreon.com/scroobiouspip, but God, I've talked enough. Let's get on with the podcast. I'll talk further in the outro. So for now, this is episode 280 with the wonderful Cariad Lloyd.
I don't wear the headphones for Griefcast. It feels a bit radio-y.
And it doesn't feel as conversational. Let's just start the podcast with that. I'm here with Cariad Lloyd.
But hello.
I mean, just speaking on Griefcast, I think Griefcast is a prime example of a podcast similar to Distraction Pieces where you wouldn't want to wear headphones and things like that, because you don't want it to feel like a formal interview. You want it to feel as relaxed as possible and as comfortable and as much of a conversation over a cup of tea as possible. So I think that is, it's weird. I get, when I'm not recording at these lovely Acast studios, I've got all this heavy podcast gear. And the reason I have it is because I've got tabletop mic stands and stuff like that, because I don't want the guests holding the mic, because I think even psychologically particularly if it's a comedian or anyone who's performed on stage, you get in performance mode. And whereas if it's just here's a mic that you're not touching and we've got line of sight, then it can just become a conversation.
It's
and relax.
Really weird, because like when I've done a few podcast chats about Griefcast, and when I started saying the things that I did, some people were like, oh right, and I, you know, when you just do it, you think, oh, it sounds like I didn't even realize I was being a genius. But what had happened was I originally recorded a studio in Camden. And it was just like above a pub, but it was fine, but it was just a bit dingy.
Yeah.
And I felt you could have an intimate conversation, but it didn't feel nice. And the reason I record all of them at Whistledown. I don't have any of my own equipment, because for me, my big thing is we can't be in my house.
Yeah.
Too distracting for me. And we can't be in the Griever's house, because I think when you're in your own home, I don't think you feel relaxed in your own home when someone's there.
Yeah,
I know, because someone said to me that's like the opposite of what they thought. But I was like, in your own house, if you came to my house now, I'd be thinking, oh God, I didn't put that sofa away, like those cushions away. And I hope Pip doesn't judge me for this, her toys are everywhere, you know.
My mum used to, briefly when we were
growing up, we had a few months where we could briefly afford a cleaner, which is very rare. We're very working class. Yeah. My mum would tidy up the day before the cleaner came because she didn't want the cleaner to see the messy house.
Exactly.
So it's exactly that. It's like anyone coming to your house, even if the purpose is to clean, you're like, oh, I don't want them to judge me though. So,
you don't want to take the piss, I think.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, oh, they think that's all right. Yeah. So yeah, it whistled down. I started recording a Radio 4 podcast there, and that's how I got to know them. But it's in an old, like a Victorian house. Like, it's the woman who started the National Trust. That's their, her old reading room is their office.
Oh, wow. That's
so it's an amazing, like, as soon as you come in, you're like, oh, this is like a lovely building. And everyone who works at Richard Dunn is the nicest. Like, they're so nice. It's like a joke. Like, literally you wave, everyone's like, hello. And it's like coming into a house, a family home that's not your family home.
Right.
And then the studio is very small. There's no windows. And it's just, I don't have a technician. We don't have headphones. I make sure I can see them. And again, it was all designed for me to be like, how can I make you feel really safe, really comfortable, and not have that, I think personal stuff is distracting, you know? Like, I think and especially when you're talking about, perhaps you're talking about death in a way that, you know, I want them to be open and I want them to, talk about the story. And I think sometimes if you see a photo of your dad and something, oh God, actually, should I be, you know, I'm telling this story. Should I be telling this story? And it sounds like I'm trying to manipulate.
How should I represent this?
No,
it's just, it's finding the right situation and settings to get the best out of the conversation rather than any manipulation on a negative level. I think there's so many words that have negative connotations.
Like
manipulation. There's nothing wrong with manipulation. You can manipulate a situation to be nicer.
Good.
It's same with selfishness. I bang on about this all the time, but I think it's essential for us to have some selfishness in our lives.
So you survive.
Otherwise, we'll all have complete breakdowns and be a mess. Yet, selfishness is seen as this negative thing. Another one I was thinking about recently is, I have such a negative reaction to any talk of taxes or raising of taxes. Taxes are great.
Oh, yeah.
But that's how we have
I thought you were like anti-race. I was like, wow.
No. It's because you're so brought up of, oh, they're raising the taxes or they're doing this, they're doing that. It's like, they're really important for our healthcare, our everything.
My husband always said when you pay, you know, because you're self-employed, you have to pay your tax, and it's always a bit stressful because it's always like this giant chunk that you're like, oh,
that
God.
You didn't know about and you weren't expecting.
Sometimes a rebate, depending on how you're doing. And he always says you should say like, oh, rather than I pay my taxes, like, oh, I bought a hospital bed. Like, in your head, it's like, oh, that's good. I'm buying a hospital bed. That's nice of me.
Completely. Like, it's so all just, about the framing on that.
Reframing it. And that's the thing. With Griefcast, like, the helpful thing, I think, maybe you had this with your podcast, is like, I always thought, well, if someone was talking to me about my dead father, what would I want them to do?
Yeah.
I was like, well, I would want a comfortable room, a cup of tea. I wouldn't want headphones on. I wouldn't want them to be distracted. Like, I wouldn't want the office itself didn't feel not, you know, dirty and horrible. This pub we used to it was fine. It was just like, you know, North London pub. It was a bit smelly. And so I was like, oh, okay. I think that's really important. Always think, well, what would you want? What would make you happy? Rather than looking for this sort of like, oh, how do I make a perfect podcast? It's like, no, well, what would you like to listen to? And how would you like to be treated? And then go from there.
Yeah, it's finding your own way of making it work as well. I get sticks sometimes. This is weird because I foolishly, at the weekend, I looked at the reviews on iTunes for the first time in literally 5 years. And there's 1,700 five-star reviews, and I looked at the one or two negative ones.
Of course, that's what we do. We head straight for that one star. Why is someone giving me one star?
But it's interesting because after it hurt, I then saw some things that I thought, actually, I can improve upon that. And other things that I was like, no, I know the reason I do that. And one of the things that someone brought up was, and it's kind of what I'm doing here, is that, oh, Pip always tries to bring in a story about himself. But I think that's another conscious tool to try and make it a conversation. Early on, I'll try and find something that we can relate on so that it's a conversation rather than, here's my questions, it's an interview. I don't want them to be an interview.
That's what's weird, is if someone say, oh, like, oh, he brings in the story, it's like, that's how people talk.
That's conversations, like,
That's conversations. Completely. If you were like, Carad, question one, what is the capital of Poland? Like,
it wouldn't be relaxing
that's
at all.
Not, and that's an interview or like a quiz.
But equally, I get it from the listener's point of view, is if...
Yeah, they listen every week.
If you listen every week and hear that the same traits every week, or just if you're used to TV interviews where it is just... Here's my question about your new film and you're going to give the same answer you've given every time. The kind of idea is to try and get away from that. So it's interesting to look at the structures that, as you kind of said, that they may be subconscious, kind of, I didn't even know I was doing it.
I think that's interesting when you make, that's what I've had with the podcast, when you make something yourself and so you don't have a boss, so you have to sort of sometimes give yourself an appraisal.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes or people comment on things and you're like, oh, I didn't know I was like, oh, I love how you do this. You think, oh, am I, is that a thing?
Yeah, yeah.
And I had the same recently. I looked at one star recently. And again, just complete backs because I wanted to check that an episode had gone through. And then you're like, why am I doing this? But I think what I think is really important is we sometimes live in a world where everyone goes, no criticism. Like, I don't want to know it. I don't want to know it. And I think it's this fine line of like nothing is so clear as that. I think you're right. Like, it's important as a podcaster or a creator of something to hear it, be upset for like 5 minutes and then go, actually, no. Fuck you. Like, you're wrong about that episode and I stand by that. Or, yeah, you're right, I do need to adjust the volume on those early episodes. Which is fine. But I think sometimes we can be like, nobody's allowed to say anything.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I don't agree with that, but I think what I don't agree with is like, just don't abuse me. Don't give me shit. Yeah. If you have a point, fine, have a point.
It's such a fine line,
isn't it? It's such a fine line, yeah.
By saying this, we now open ourselves up to knobheads. I know, I thought that, yeah. We're going to go, I think you should know that. Yeah. It's like, all right, well, I don't want all the, like, because again, I've always found, it's a weird one. Since doing club nights, I've realised how arrogant it is to go and request a song.
Oh, really?
Because there's several hundred people in that room
who
are all dancing and enjoying yourselves, and you're going, I want to listen to my song.
Oh, yeah, that's so
Whereas
true.
If the night's going well, that is, it's the most arrogant thing. Yeah, I used to always do it as a team.
I used to request songs, yeah.
And I've always done that at clubs. But, if the club's going off.
Only bangers. Only if it's like proper, like, this is a banger.
Yeah, yeah. This will work. But, it is a bizarre and strangely, as I said, arrogant thing to go, song, please. But it's similar on that. It's people going, I don't like this about your podcast. Yeah. And it's like, well, my thing has always been, and there's a rapper called Jean Grey, who I'm a big fan of and have known for a while. And her thing has always been, go and do it yourself then. Like, go and do it better.
I couldn't agree more.
And podcasting isn't, there's no better industry for that, because you can literally go and do it yourself. If you're not happy with how someone does stuff, stop listening. It was free anyway.
Yeah,
and just go and do it yourself.
I'm really lucky with Griefcast, actually, because I've had, I shouldn't like set myself up, but the negative, compared to all the other things I do, which are obviously more comedy and more performative, where people really do feel that it's okay to say they don't like you or what you said.
Yeah.
But because Griefcast is this place of death, what I like about it is the people who listen to it tend to get rid of the dickheads, because they can't face listening to an episode with someone talking about, you know, losing their baby at 5 months. It's like, well, you're going to tweet me and that woman about that, are you? That the volume was too low, are you?
Yes.
So it kind of clears a lot of people. But then, interesting enough, I did an episode recently with someone who was much higher profile in a mainstream way. Maybe I won't say their name, just to be fair, but you'd know if you looked at the list. And they were getting Twitter abuse for their actions after someone they loved had died. And I couldn't. It really shocked me, because that's the first Griefcast Twitter. My social media is a place of love. There's the criticism normally is your volume or that person spoke quietly. And you know, you're like, oh, all right, turn it up, listen to it differently. What can I do? But this was very an interesting way of, I was actually upset. I found it really upsetting, because the upset of, oh, I don't like your podcast, or didn't like you on Have I Got News For You, you know, it's ego. But the way some people were tweeting this person about what had happened to him after someone he'd loved had died and the decisions he'd made afterwards, I found really shocking of like, wow, people really don't think through what they're tweeting.
Do you think it's a social media thing? Because it is instant access and instant, again, not time to think about the concept or what you're saying. Would they have written a letter to that person to say, I think that, if they'd started writing it, they would have gone, oh, man, why am I doing this? This is kind of horrible and hateful.
I think letters
Whereas it feels so throwaway.
Yeah, I think if you had to write letters, you'd lose about 60% of all the tweets.
Yeah.
And then I think the next thing to do is, would you say that to someone's face? And I actually tweeted someone. I never get involved with stuff normally, since I've had Twitter storms, and it's horrible. But I actually tweeted this, and I said, you know, would you say that to his face if you saw him in the street? Like, can you think about what you're... And, you know, obviously... they don't. Oh, well, that's just my opinion. And you're like, yeah, but you're not entitled.
It's rudeness.
Yeah, but she said, I'm entitled to my opinion. And what I thought was interesting, like, of course you are, but you're not entitled to shout it at someone. Yeah. Like, that's what I find weird is...
I couldn't agree more.
Like, and I, again, same, the tweets I have had, criticism, grief cards, which are very few. I'd say it's the nicest social media place to live in. It's so supportive. But I always think it's just you wouldn't speak like that to me. Yeah. You know, you'd say, oh, if you saw me in the street, you'd be like, oh, I do like it. That was that one episode. The volume was a bit quiet. But what I guess, I'm fed up of listening to them. And you think, actually, I'm making it like it's really quiet. It's not. It was the first four episodes that I edited myself were a bit quiet. I'm just trying to choose something generic.
Yeah.
So I just think it's, as ever, you know, the classic joke is like, it's the way I tell them, isn't it? It's like, yeah, it's the way you say something.
Yeah.
You allowed your thoughts, but think about how you communicate them.
I mean, I've always felt as well, people, I've never, thankfully, I've never been one that needs everyone to like me or love me or have any desire for that. So as soon as I was making music or anything in the public eye, I didn't feel, I've never felt it's for everyone.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with that. But my thought is, if you're going to slag me off, just type, I think Scroobius Pip is shit. Don't type, I think at Scroobius Pip, yo, is shit. It's like,
I know.
That's rude, because that's knocking on my door to say, but by the way, I'm not a fan of you. It's like, why are you at my door?
But I do think, and I hope it doesn't sound patronising, that if you don't work in the performance industry, in whatever state, I mean, literally, if you're not someone who stands on stage, then I think you just don't understand what atting someone means.
Yeah.
And I said this tiny bit of abuse that happened recently with a guest, they were atting him in. And that's what I agree with you. If you want to tweet that you think his behaviour is bad, fine. But why would you at someone? But I think it's that lack of understanding of what Twitter is like. That's your phone. Not only do you have Twitter on your phone, you sleep with it next to your bed. It's got pictures of your family on. Like, it's a small home you carry with you.
It's a weird private place that you don't realise.
Yeah, it's like a hermit crab shell. Like, it's there. So when you come into my phone and you say, it's not, I don't know you, I don't care. It's like you've not only knocked on my door, it's like you've smashed up on my window, stuck your head in and shouted, fuck you, at me and my family.
Yeah.
And you think, well, I don't think you needed to do that.
Yeah.
Like, a polite letter.
I mean, I concede it was a bit quiet.
Yeah. You're right. I'm working on it. I got an editor, Kate Holland. She's amazing. She made it better. But yeah, I just think there was one particular person who, again, I don't want to give any more fuel to, who was tweeting this person. And when I looked, maybe I shouldn't say this, but when I looked at her profile, I was like, oh, you have no concept of what social media, like, the profile was insane. It was just like really mad.
Yeah.
Really mad. You know, when you look at someone's Twitter and you think, I don't think you ever even read Twitter. I think you just type things in and put your phone down.
But that's the weird thing as well. That's also completely acceptable and understandable. It's weird.
Totally
like there is that world where people in any industry where social media can be used as a part of your job,
as
promotion, you get to know it that bit better. You get to understand
exactly,
bit more.
Yeah.
I have some posts, like, my mum and dad are both on socials. In general, they're both great. Every now and then, my dad on his food page, he'll post something and I'll be around his next time and go, you know, that made no sense whatsoever. And I'll explain why. And it just wouldn't have clicked. And there's nothing wrong with that. So again, it's not rude to say that you looked on that person's page and they didn't really know what was going on. Cause it's like, well, no, they probably don't. And that's
okay too.
It's just,
after what she said to that person, I was like, oh, now I can judge you. You're going to be that judgmental in such an unbelievable way. I thought, I'm going to judge you now.
Smash the window. I can look through it as well.
Yeah, no, I can stick
my head through the hole that you made.
What are you wearing? Yes. Well, that doesn't go. I know, it's fine. And I sometimes think, oh, it must be so, if you know, I'm just like, oh, poor you, your social media is hot. And so I try not to moan about it too much. And as I said, Griefcast, what I love, I find Twitter really difficult. I'm not really on there that much anymore. But the Griefcast Twitter, I get, I'd say daily, people saying, you know, act the Griefcast. It's my dad's anniversary tomorrow. First year. I have no idea what to do. Can you help? I then retweet and I say, hey, griefsters, any ideas? And people just pile in with, oh, well, I did this. We lit a candle. We went for a meal. We listened to the music that he liked all day. We went to see his favourite film. Where do you live? DM me. I'm going to be on my phone all day. If you have it, like, this sudden, like, whoosh, like, we're here. We're here for you.
Yeah.
And I think, God, as ever with all things, there's never good or bad. They are a very marbled mix of everything.
Yeah.
And I think, God, that is when social media is magic, because that person, completely alone, is just, you know, their parents just died or so-and-so's just died. They wouldn't know all these people here. And it's the only way they've connected is Twitter. Like, that was incredible.
I love
and
that.
Then they become like, sometimes I see them tweeting without me, you know. Oh, I was thinking of you yesterday. It's the birthday, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, thanks so much. And how's yours coming up? And you see this support network forming because they've lost people in similar ways, or just because they've lost people. And I think, God, if it wasn't for Twitter and Instagram, like, they would be struggling where to take that pain.
Yeah, I mean, with all the negatives of social media, there are these amazing little pockets of wonder. And the Griefcast one is one that I've looked on and witnessed for this community. And there's also, I follow a fair few scientists or Greg Jenner, this historian.
I love Greg Jenner.
He's an example of, if he has a question about a specific area of history, he can just post about it. And because of the little circle he has there, there will be all these fascinating experts who
chip
in and go, oh, here's this part of it. And did you know this? And this has recently been discovered. And that's beautiful to have these little...
pockets of niceness.
these kind of... these hive minds that aren't just there to cancel people and attack people and to take people down and to be shocked and outraged at everything.
There was a really lovely one. There's a regular tweeter who tweets quite a lot to me, and she said, is anyone going to Glastonbury this year? Can you say hello to Nat, who I think was her partner who died? And she said, it's the first year I can't go, and she spread his ashes there.
Oh, wow.
And she said they'd bought the tickets for Glastonbury just before he died. And I think she might be, please forgive me, you know who you are if I get this wrong, but I think she's about 3 years in. And so she specifically said, Karen, can you retweet this? And then literally like five or six people were like, I'm going, I'll go and say hello. And
it's
oh my, like that made me so emotional because I was like, oh, just so she can know someone's just going to go to that field. She was like, I'll tell you where the field is. I spread his ashes and just say hello. So because she couldn't make it this year. And I thought, oh, God, that stuff really gives me the goosebumps. I think that is the magic of humanity that you forget in the... I hate this person, they're not funny, Brexit is bad, Brexit is good. Like, all the shouting is, you know.
It's beautiful, isn't it? I mean, 20 minutes in, we should probably explain what Griefcast is to anyone who doesn't. Like, we've been chatting away because we know. But
you made such a relaxed conversation. Normally I always explain
it's I mean, often in the podcasts I'll make...
They'd be so confused. They'd be like, why are
what's going on?
Why is it such a nice place?
Oh, it's a weird one with this because I plan the podcast in advance, obviously, and I like to plan either the day before or the morning of because I like it to all be fresh. I think
sometimes
I'll literally have to hold off because there'll be someone I'm excited about.
And I'll be
wanting to look into it the week before. But it's like, no, I want to do it on the day so it's all fresh. But normally I'll start with kind of some... growing up type stuff and then build onto it. But there's a key moment in your growing up, which is the reason for Griefcast. So it kind of means we jump straight into Griefcast anyway. So would you like to kind of explain?
Yeah, I should explain. So Griefcast, I wonder what they think right now. God, it's only very strange. So Griefcast is a podcast where I interview mostly comedians, but these days it's sort of all sorts of people, about their experiences of grief and death.
Yeah.
And we just have a roughly an hour chat about what their story is, what happened to them. And it can range from people talking about parents, brothers, sisters, grandparents, children, miscarriages, lost pregnancies, dog, friends. So a complete spectrum of grief and all ways of dying, from, you know, illness to sudden to unexpected to, you know, all sorts. And the reason I do it, because everyone's always like, and why would you, what inspired you? Someone just asked me on interview.
What would make you do such a thing?
So my dad died when I was 15. And so I had a very open family. We talked about it a lot. And we've always talked about everything a lot, mostly. And so I feel like I've spent 20 years talking about it. And so I feel like I've sort of practiced talking about it.
Yeah.
And I would have these conversations with people. So I'm the kind of girl at a party, like I'm in the kitchen and somebody starts talking to me, and before you know it, I discovered they've also lost someone and we're having this chat about death, and it's only 8:30 and everyone's like, oh, Carrie's really bumming us out. And I would have really deep chats with someone and I'd think, oh, it's just gone, isn't it? Once it's gone, you know. And that's what sort of inspired me. I was like, it'd be nice to like record those conversations, because sometimes you have really revelations about your grief or their grief or what it means to be a human. So I started it about 2.5 years ago, and very much not thinking it would be, we're on like episode 86 now. Like I honestly thought I might do 10 episodes and maybe 10 people would listen. And
I mean, again, sadly, it's weird because we discussed this a little bit. I should mention that we recorded an episode of the Pod Bible podcast. And it was really tough because I knew we had this booked in. And I was like, I just want to continue on for hours and hours.
Stop chatting.
But we talked about there, it's bizarre how much we avoid speaking about death because it is the one thing that literally all of us personally and through those connected to us are going to experience and go through. And I had the experience of when I put my first album out and it had two songs about suicide on there, and my next album had a song about death, that all the reviews were like, oh, it's quite a, or in interviews I'd say, oh, you're quite morbid. And I'd be like, am I?
Yeah.
I honestly didn't know, because I'd thankfully been brought up in that same thing of where my family have spoken quite openly about death, I think we should. So that conversation at the party shouldn't be, oh, Carrie had bumming us out. It should be, well, that was another conversation, and
I know.
A valuable thing. And I think that's what's been great. The thing that I loved as soon as I started listening to Griefcast was I put it off for ages because I thought,
Everyone's like,
TV shows,
I've got to be ready.
I need to be in the right mood. Needs to be the right time. And you don't.
That's
what's been great.
Yeah.
After I've listened to the first one, I was like, oh, you don't. That can just be put it on. It's not this heavy. Obviously, it gets heavy in places, but it is quite.
Its general tone isn't heavy. Yeah, weirdly.
Cheery and chatty and friendly. And like a lot of comedians, gallows humour means that there's a lot of.
Some of it's hilarious.
Of lightness and jokes being made to make everyone comfortable and relaxed, I guess. So
And I think because I'm a comedian and that's my background. And so when you and that's the original reason I chose to speak to comedians was like my biggest thing was like I don't want it to be depressing.
Yeah.
Because you know I suffer great grief, and so I don't want to have a conversation and come out and think, oh bloody hell, like we're gonna die. So I wanted a space where we could talk about it really honestly and about the weird stuff that happens and the stupid stuff that makes you laugh when someone's dying and the weird stuff that happens in hospices and the stupid things people say and just laugh about it. And like you said, some episodes obviously are really, you know, much harder than others, but there's always this again, same as I'm saying about Twitter, life isn't sad and happy. Life is this mixture of things. And like social media is such a mirror of what our society is, which is why sometimes it's really horrible and frustrating. And the same with like death isn't this sad thing that happens to you and then you get over it. Like it's not a holiday where you go, oh, I went to Spain. I'm not there now.
Yeah.
Like it's, we're all going to go through it. Not a single person in the world will not experience it unless you're the first to die. And that's morbid. And like, it's sad and it's happy and sometimes it's joyful because somebody's been ill for a long time and they're not in pain anymore. Yeah. And sometimes it's so painful. But when you come through it, this magic happens where you do things you wouldn't have done. So I don't think you can separate it into like, oh, it's sad, therefore the podcast is sad, therefore I don't want to listen to it. I think what I like about Griefcast and doing it is that you realise like, oh, every experience of my life is mixed of sadness and happiness and joy and depression and anxiety and wonder, and they're all, some of them are louder than others at that moment.
Yeah.
And actually what death does is just turn up, makes things very clear. You just suddenly, you know, all the distractions of life are sort of gone. You're like, oh, that's how I feel about this person and that's how I feel about my life. I can really see it because somebody's died. And so, yeah, I really wanted it to be something that would get sad maybe in the show, you know, that arc of your show. But I wanted it to be when you pressed pause and didn't listen to the end advert, because that nobody does. I wanted you to feel okay. I didn't want you to go, oh, I feel shit. I wanted you to think, oh, you know what? They had an awful experience and they're all right. They're laughing. Maybe I'll be all right.
I think one of the key bits, I mean, it's weird now because I've touched upon bringing my own stories into stuff.
Please do.
I mean, I think it's one of, I think on Griefcast, one of the key things is you've experienced so many points along the journey of grief.
Yeah.
So when you bring it back to your experiences, it's absolutely key. It's not any kind of, oh, you're bringing it back to yourself. It's like, no, that's key for relaxing the person and for getting them out, because you lost your father so many years ago now.
Yeah.
Or a decent amount of years ago. Somebody made it sound as if you're a withered 70-year-old lady.
So long,
I mean,
ago.
so long ago now.
I can't remember him. Yeah.
But it means that you've seen the different
I've gone
moments,
through a lot
the different
of cycles
parts,
of
the bits
grief,
where it will
yeah.
have come back up yeah, and yeah. gone back down and the points where you'd think you're okay with it and then yeah. something happens and you find out you're not.
You're not.
And I think that's what is key in that is that your guests are at different points or yeah. have different journeys. When Adam Buxton was on, it was a fresh and new thing.
He was really
for
fresh,
him.
Yeah. Dad died like I think about 4 or 5 months and, when he spoke to me.
And that was amazing because he'd spoken about it on his podcast and been really kind of as it was happening, he'd been
yeah, yeah.
amazingly it was like an audio diary and it was gut wrenching. But particularly again with podcasts you feel that you really connect with someone and yeah. they're a close friend. So I've met Adam a couple of times and we've chatted a bit, but I wouldn't assume that he's ever thinking about me when we're not there. But that meant that the intimacy of hearing him go yeah. through that, and then it was such an exciting and celebratory thing to see, oh, he's on Griefcast. Oh, thank God.
And do you know what's funny?
Thank God he's not on his own
yeah,
and he's talking to someone. And it, do you know what I mean? It really was yeah. that kind of... Because it's weird with podcasts is we let people into certain little bits and
yeah.
they don't know any of the others. So I... weirdly was concerned about
yeah, course,
how Adam is,
yeah,
how he's
I
doing,
was,
how
yeah.
he's getting along. And then to see that he was doing Griefcast, like, oh, that's really good for him yeah. as a person because he's quite a chatty person. He's not going to be someone who needs, or you wouldn't have thought he's someone who's like, I need to leave it a year or
yeah,
so.
Yeah.
He's going to be someone who wants to dissect it and figure out what the hell's going on. And that seemed like the perfect
Yeah, it was interesting because I didn't know him properly before. I sort of, you know, obviously I knew who it was
yeah.
and I loved his podcast and I loved Adam and Joe show. And then we had a friend in common, and when I started Griefcast, because he'd been talking about it, I thought, oh, I wonder if... I always approach people when they have been public. If they haven't been public, I do yeah. not approach, because obviously that's very clear they don't want to talk about it. And then people will message me, you should get so-and-so on. Yeah. Their dad's just died. And I'm like, they obviously don't want to talk about it. So because he'd been public, I got his email from a friend. And I emailed him and said, you know, just because you have been talking about, would you want to come and talk about it? And he said, are you like qualified in any way to talk about this? And I was like, no, absolutely not. I'm just in the club, as we say.
Yeah.
And he was very kind to come and talk and be so open when he was, you know, so fresh. And what's interesting, I think, for some of my guests, which again, did not think was going to happen, is I record them at a very particular moment of their grief. And some of them have said to me, they then listened to it a year later and gone, oh my God, like I didn't know that that's how I was feeling. I couldn't see what I was in denial about, or yeah. I could, but you're sort of, it's like recording a therapy, you know, you can take this little snapshot of, oh, at 6 months you felt like this, this is what you were saying. And then yeah. a year later they're like, oh, I don't feel like that anymore. So I love that there's this little snapshot of that grief at that point.
Yeah.
And when I'm booking, I really try to get, yeah, the mix of people who are like, as we say, fresh out of the box, to people like me, 20, 30 years on, to people, you know, so that if you're a listener and you say to me, oh, I'm 5 years in and it was my mum and I'm sad, I can go, oh, you should listen to
yeah.
this episode. So trying to find something, because the grief does change massively, obviously, over the course of a lifetime. And there's that, like you said, that very strange thing that's happened to me of like, I sort of accidentally got this job 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Without knowing it.
Yeah, yeah.
But because I then, you know, then sometimes people say to me, oh, like, how comes you're good at talking about it? Like, I've been doing it for 20 years. Like,
yeah.
no one was recording it. But for 20 years, I've been asking people, oh, what happened? And did you go to the hospital?
Yeah,
and what was it like for you?
I'm really good at comedy and I haven't been doing that for 20 years.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I've been doing that for less time than I've been doing
yeah,
this.
Yeah.
Therefore,
oh,
I've
the
got
death
more
chats.
Experience of it.
Yeah, I've got way more experience talking about death. Definitely.
You know?
I actually think I feel more comfortable doing it.
Do you have any set kind of or go-to recommended or recommendations for people who are struggling? Something I have a lot is because I had these songs early on that
yeah.
were about suicide and stuff like that, is I'm really vigilant on my social media. I'll keep an eye because I know that
touch,
I've
yeah.
got people who have got a deeper connection than
yeah.
just, oh, I like that song.
Yeah.
And one of the things I always panic about is I'll help as much as I can, but I'll always try and be really clear. I'm not
qualified. Yeah.
Qualified. I don't want you to become attached to someone who doesn't know what they're talking about, or to someone who might be then off doing a film for a month
yeah,
and not check
yeah.
my messages. So I'm a big... My mum has worked at Samaritans for years, and I've worked with Calm since their first year. So they're two charities that I'm very familiar with. I'm a big fan of, and I'll kind of I'll push people towards, and I'll, again, it's trying to word it as if I'm not just palming them off.
Yeah,
because Samaritans in particular is one that everyone's aware of, but it's kind of seen as this, I don't know, getting help in general in society. It's changing now, but certainly in my years of growing up, it's kind of seen as a,
something wrong with you.
I'm all right. There's nothing wrong
I'm not that
wrong
bad.
With me. So how do you tread that line of being in the club but not being an expert, if you know what I mean? So being there for that conversation, but also being able to be clear that, look, if you need further, all this is a conversation. Yeah. Here's what you might want to follow up with or follow up on.
It's easier on the Twitter, but I have the exact same problem as you of, like, I have to make it very clear. Like, I'm not. I've never done any counselling training ever. Like.
But again, I mean, to be clear, there's nothing wrong with that. I think these situations, talking to anyone is a really important first step. The next step, hopefully, is speaking to an expert, speaking to a family member or anyone that you can. But so it's not a bad thing. Like, I always feel that's the fact that they've reached out to you or to me or whoever else.
Oh, yeah, that's wicked. But you just want to be clear, like, please, like, I worry. That's my thing, is I worry. Yeah. Like, you know, it's like if someone said to me, do you want to change this tyre? I'd be like, oh, I can't. I'll give it a go. I'll always give it a go, but don't blame me if it falls off down the road. So, yeah, on the Twitter, it's slightly easier because you can direct them, obviously, to places. And I get, you know, someone emailed me yesterday saying, I think I can say, I always, you know, make sure to keep it anonymous, but someone literally emailed me yesterday saying, my dad's died today. What the hell do I do? And I was like, you know, I'm about to go to bed. And I thought, okay, this one needs to be replied to. And so I'm the same as you. I it's not palming off, but I'm very clear. Like, what's happened to you is fucking awful. Yeah. You're going to feel pretty bad. There are services that can help you. And I guess it's the other good thing of being 20 years in. I know I'm not going to make you feel better. Nothing is going to make you feel better for some time. Yeah. So that's just fact. So I always recommend Cruise Bereavement Care, C-R-U-S-E, who offer lots of free bereavement counselling. Not everywhere is free, but they have a really good service. And if you tweet them, they often can help you. There's someone on Twitter called the Good Grief Trust who have lots of resources of bereavement stuff. Yeah. There's a lady called Catherine Mannix who's written a book called With the End in Mind. She's an ex-palliative care consultant. Oh, she'll kill me, something like that. And she's very active on Twitter about resources and where to go. And her book, With the End in Mind, is one of the best books I've read about. Hers is about how all these people died.
Yeah.
So if anybody's anxious about it, I always recommend it because she really talks about just the physical process of what happened, literally what happens to your body.
Wow.
And it's incredible. And the other one I recommend is Julia Samuel Griefworks, who is a grief psychotherapist who started Child Bereavement UK. And she's an amazing woman. And her book, Griefworks, is case studies of her time as a grief psychotherapist. Yeah. And her book's there's an introduction and a conclusion that's very clear about what grief literally is. Because I think sometimes you can feel you're just like, I'm just so sad and I'm so upset. And that's all I'm aware of. And you don't realise that the same part of your brain that lights up when you're grieving lights up when you're depressed. So it's that bit of your brain that will make you feel isolated. Yeah. But I remember thinking, oh, it's not a feeling. I am. No one understands. I am alone. And that's why I always end the show cheesily with, like, you're not alone, because you're chemically being told no one fucking gets it.
Yeah.
But it's not true. There are people who get it. There are people who can help you. And it's about, you know, again, with all mental health, it's like separating that feelings aren't facts, you know, like you're feeling this very overwhelming thing, but there's people out there who can help. And with time, which I know is the worst thing in the world, it won't go away. I always say this, it's not going, people will email me, well, when will it stop, Carrot? And I'm like, I'm 20 years in. What do you want me to say to you? Like, but it will get easier. The waves of grief we talk about a lot are less, or I think what really happens is you get used to them. So if I have a bad day, which I would say is quite rare these days, you know, I maybe have two or three times a year, I'll get like a big kind of like, oh, fuck, I feel awful today. You know, when you're fresh out of the box, you're getting that every hour.
Yeah.
So the waves get much less. But what happens now, if I have a bad day, or if I'm really not even miss, I don't even miss him anymore because it's too long to miss someone. It's just that feeling of like, oh, I'm sad because my dad was never here. What happens is you go, oh, I've lived through this. I remember this. I remember getting through this. Yeah. I remember how long it's going to take. So you just get really good at going, oh, this isn't a too bad. This could be fixed with a bit of ice cream and watching The American Office for 2 hours, I think. Like, you kind of have to judge it, you know?
Learning those triggers or learning when it's a problem and learning what your solutions are. I think the great thing about, you mentioned the book that goes through a load of case studies.
Yeah, Griefworks.
And it's similar, I think, with Griefcast as well, is that going, reading or hearing about a lot of different experiences, you're going to find similarities in there. Because the fact is, with grief, as with any mental health thing, is it's so personal and so individual.
Yes, exactly,
and that can that can make it feel isolating. So while someone, you might be right that no one has gone through what you're going through, but they've gone through that part of it. And this person over here has gone through that part of it. So the individual puzzle that you've made is unique, but the pieces match other puzzles as well. And you can find that connection and find what...
We always say on the show, like, your grief, of course, is unique because your relationship to that person was only created with the two of you. So my brother has a very different relationship to my dad than I do. And that's, you know, in the same family. And he's not making a podcast and talk about it. He doesn't really need to do that at all. So I think that's such a good example of, like, how unique it can be. And yet how, like you said, how helpful it can be. Like, I thought my dad had died of a very rare, strange cancer until I started Griefcast. And so he died of pancreatic cancer.
Right.
And once I started talking about it, PCRF and PCUK, who are big pancreatic cancer charities, got in touch and, you know, started helping me with, you know, actual statistics. And I found out, oh, it's the fifth biggest cancer causer in the UK. Like, its funding hasn't changed since
the 1970s. I was going to say, it's the problem with pancreatic is why it can seem so obscure is that it's not a pretty or fancy one. It's not a breast or one of these where people
want to
get behind and go, here's the thing. It's one of the biggest killers, yet one of the least supported and funded.
It's unbelievable. Its funding hasn't changed since the 1970s because it's such a and again, this is the other thing I've learned. People think cancers are the same thing. Cancers are complete, like, different in different parts of your body and very treatable in different parts of your body. And the pancreas, like, has barely any symptoms and it normally isn't found until it's spread, which is why the survival rates are, like, literally, like, it's 7%. It's insanely awful because by the time you are ill, it's very much... This happened to my dad. It really, really spread. So he went yellow, literally turned yellow. And then they were like, oh, it must be liver cancer. And then when they started looking, they were like, oh, it's spread from his liver. It's pancreas.
Right.
And yeah, it's, you know, but the thing, I had grown up thinking, oh, he had this very strange, weird thing that no one I've ever met has ever had. I've never heard anyone mention it again. I start talking about it. You know, a girl emailed me who literally had the same story, but she was in New Zealand. She was like, I was 15. He died really quickly. It was my dad, pancreatic cancer. And I was like, this is so nice in a way to know, like, oh, nice sounds wrong, but like, oh, I see. I was just going through a really normal human experience. Yeah. Like, and obviously it's rare to lose a dad that young, but it also isn't. There's also people going through that. And when you feel like you've had a weird thing, I think that really, you feel like ashamed and a bit like, oh, I had this strange thing that no one understands. No one will understand me. It's a thing that I probably won't talk about because it's weird.
Yeah.
But then when you, the grief community, you're like, oh, there's loads of us. Yeah. Oh, I see.
And nice is the right word.
Yeah,
and
it shouldn't be
shied away from. I speak.
She was really happy. She emailed me like, oh my God, me too.
It's a beautiful thing is finding those moments of happiness. I've talked a few times about my favourite day of the year is April 25th every year because it's the day that my mate, Jamie, it was his birthday, and when we were both 21, he took his own life. And it was horrible for so long. But as you said, there's a point where you stop missing them because it's just weird. I'm not the same person.
Yeah.
He would probably think I'm a dick. He wouldn't, or I would look at him and go, what? Because he's 21 still.
He's
never changed that. But there was a point where it became, oh, right, actually, every day on this year, if I go on Facebook, all my friends are sharing really nice, happy memories about him. And every year, me and my mates, or most years, we'll go around to his mum and dad's house and his brother's there. And
so
we all just have a barbecue and talk about nice stuff. And it seems weird. And the first time I'd mentioned it, I'd feel uncomfortable saying, I love that day.
Because
it's a horrible day. It's the anniversary of a death. But no, it's okay to love that because we don't spend all day, every day thinking of these things. And it's beautiful to have these moments where you go, right, today I'm going to hear another story that I've never heard, or the same story I hear of his dad every year that I love hearing because I'm not close to his parents in that way that we live next to each other and we hang out. So, yeah, it can be a beautiful and nice thing to find those points in grief that can give you that warmth.
Yeah.
I've always said it's something that I've seen in social media in recent years. Tragedies obviously are horrific. They're tragedies.
Yeah, yeah.
But they also can bring the absolute best out of humans.
Yeah,
the times that you see everyone come together in a square because of a tragedy that's happened and all be there together. I'm getting emotional now thinking about it. Or when you see everyone singing a Prince song after Prince died. Thousands of people. That's the best of humanity. And that comes because of grief. So there is beauty in there. Whilst it's this ugly, horrible thing, there's beauty in there. And that should be okay to acknowledge and not feel, oh, I should feel bad for being happy about this. Or being, do you know what I mean? Enjoying that moment.
Like, grief and death is, that's in the sad room. And it can't have anything else in it.
Yeah.
And I completely agree with that. If you can reframe a day and make it a celebration of their life, then, like, why the fuck not? Like,
yeah, it was, I mean, again, you know? And to be clear, it was years and years later. There was many years where, like, we didn't
the first year,
meet
we
up
like,
or hang out or anything. It's like a good
five, ten years
down the line, we were like, shall we meet up? It's Jay's birthday again. So, and then it just became this thing that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is. It's that, I mean, I talked about it on, I did a podcast with, or Stu, who does the Pod Bible thing, who you met. He's got a podcast called Hardcore Listing, where they do just top fives of anything. And we did, I had them on here to do top five songs that make you cry, which is a mess of an episode because we're literally getting emotional going over the lyrics. But one of the examples of that was Don't Look Back in Anger after the Manchester attack. And when they perform that, and there's these people who have all recently lost this, but this huge part of their life, but they're there together with other people who've been through that, and they're singing a song that the lyrics now are a million times more poignant. There's a beauty in that, and that's the beautiful thing. Again, it's such a British thing to hide away our grief, our pain, our emotions in general. And it's in moments like that that you go, all right, if we let the... And again, Griefcast is a prime example. If we allow ourselves to let these emotions out, as I said, it's not a depressing hour of a podcast.
Yeah, no, it's not.
It has its moments.
Because also, any human emotion doesn't last that long. Like, it's very hard to just sob for an hour.
Yeah.
And, you know, anyone who's grieving will tell you, you can sob and rack and, like, make the most weird honking noise possible, but you can't do it for that long. Your body sort of stops you. It's like, I think we're done. And you might do it again in 10 minutes, but, like, that, nothing can last that long. And I think what you're talking about, which I think is so interesting, is connection.
Yeah.
And I think we're in a really strange time where we are more connected than we've ever been, but we're also, I mean, it's such a cliche thing to say, but we're also, like, more isolated.
I completely agree.
But, like, to see, you know, in the days when you lived in the same village and you would have come together as a community when something awful happened, that wouldn't have seemed so strange. And I think sometimes now, because there's just so many people in our, like, lives, there's so much connection.
Yeah.
So when you see something like that, like after a tragedy, somebody coming together, I think it reminds you somehow, it's like you said, a real human trait of, like, oh, it actually is just the people in my village. Like, that's actually why I need to care about them, because we're all living in the same place, and their pain upsets me because I'm affected by it. But I think sometimes we try and push that. That feeling's very difficult. To know that you're affected by other people's pain is very difficult, because it means you're vulnerable and it means that you will feel pain. And I think that's why when we're overwhelmed with pain, you know, the media and the news and things are happening, you think, oh, it's too much pain. I don't care about those people, or I don't know them, or I'm just going to have to put it out there, because to realise, like, everybody's pain in this world is going to somehow affect you. Of course it is. Of course it is.
Yeah.
Whether it, you know.
But so equally, it's fine that it is such a, it can be such a quick on and off. And your example there of when you've cried all you can cry. I've had that before where
it's such a
literally
funny feeling, isn't it?
A minute later I'm like, all right, well, that happened then. I'm going to go and get some food. Because it is such. So that's completely acceptable on the grander scales of grief as well. On reading about something, you can be emotional and then go and enjoy a computer game.
Yeah, yeah.
or go and laugh with your mates. It doesn't mean you're a bad person.
No, no. But I think it's like letting that space in. I think we sometimes, like I said, we fight the sadness so hard.
Yeah.
And I know I did that for years. Like, I talk about it on the show all the time of like, I just was like, I'm fine. Because I just was so, my thing was like, I was so afraid. If I open that door to grief, I don't know if I can ever close it.
Yeah.
I honestly thought I'll just cry forever. Yeah. And then the more I dealt with it, I went to therapy. And I mean, literally like 18 years after he died, I finally went and started dealing with it. And then I was like, oh, I see, you can cry and then you just stop. And then you feel a bit better. But I was so afraid of, being vulnerable. I think grief is such an overwhelming feeling. It's such a, and if you haven't through it, it can seem a bit odd of like, it does take over your whole brain and your whole life.
I think all these things can also be confusing because there's guilt involved as well because there's how you should be reacting. And again,
oh my God,
when you do have that first point where you realise that you don't miss them as such anymore.
Yeah,
you haven't thought about them that day?
That
can be a horrible, feel so bad. I'm terrible. Yeah. I'm such a horrible. No, again, all of that is perfectly natural.
That's what I love about Griefcast is there's so many things, so many episodes when people have said to me, this is like, they feel so bad. They'll be like, I did this thing. And I'm like, you're like the 25th person to say you did that. Like, it's so, and then they're like, oh, really? Like, the amount of times people say they left the room and the person died and they feel so guilty. And having spoken to palliative care nurses, they're like, oh yeah, all the time. Because, and this Catherine Mannix said to me, she was like, she's like, you know, there's no evidence, there's no science for this, but I think some people wait until you've left the room. Just like, and some people don't. Some people hang on and they want you in the room. Some people want to do it by themselves.
I would completely want to do it by myself. Exactly. I wouldn't want anyone there. I'd want to be like, I don't want them to look at me. I might look horrible when I do it, or weird, or they're going to feel bad.
And
it's going to be...
So many guests have been like torturing themselves, going like, I just want to get a cup of tea. I'd been there for a week as a vigil and I just... And then when you sort of listen, because I've listened obviously to all these episodes, done them all, you go, God, it's always happening.
Yeah.
And
that person spent a week going, would you just go and get a cup of tea, please?
Yeah.
I'm exhausted.
But that made me so, it made me so happy, because then when people go, again, the thing with guilt and shame, isn't it? Once you share it and people go, oh yeah, me too. You're like, oh, I don't have to feel guilty for laughing at laughing in a hospice, making jokes around a dead body, like stuff. Yeah. We're all doing these things. And what I think is interesting is comedians are happier to admit it because it's funny and we don't mind. We're like, yeah, it's funny. So as long as it's funny, I don't really care what the consequences are. And then I think that's been helpful for people listening to be like, oh, I get so many emails from people being like, oh, I didn't like to tell anyone, but we had a very funny incident after that my so-and-so died. And we all felt very guilty about laughing. I'm like, no, it's so shit. Grief's so awful. If you can get some peace and laughter in the middle of it, take
100%, 100%. Well, I mean... Speaking of scientific or medical proof, what's your belief in the afterlife? because it's a weird one. Because I don't believe there's anything there yet. There's certain things I do. Like I like to go to a park near my nan's. I like to have a peep at her old house. I like to do stuff, and I like to think of her and think that she'd like this. And same with my mate Jay. There's certain things I do that I'm like, oh, he would have loved that. Or I'll specifically go somewhere, like visiting graves. I visit the graves of people I've lost, and I think it's a beautiful thing. Yet my logical mind, I don't believe in it. I don't believe they're here anymore. And I was thinking of it when you mentioned the Glastonbury thing, because my thought was instantly, I was like, if I was there, I would have gone there and said hello to Nick. And then I thought, thinking, I would have, even though I don't believe there's any... Like, it's this weird...
It's really weird, isn't it?
This weird thing.
I was raised very, like, you know... not particularly Church of England school hall, and so my parents would have said, oh, we're Christian, but not, you know, they were also in a cult and doing weird stuff, so like they you know, they weren't exactly like normal compared, like my husband was raised like actually like militant atheist, like completely, like we went to a church wedding once and he was so, you know, that when you just sort of, things you get used to say, like, and also with you, and he was like, why is everyone standing, what's happening now? And I was like, oh yeah, if you haven't had any of it, you don't, you
it's
know, that's
so
of,
weird. I grew up in it all as well, and when you go back to it, you are like, wow, this feels culty.
Yeah,
this feels trance like.
You just sort of, but that stuff that, you know, so when after my dad died, I was very I didn't think he'd gone to heaven, but I definitely felt his presence. Mm. And I think that's what I've got as I've got older, similar to you, which is probably a very, like, I'm sure someone religious would be like, fucking liberal, like, comedian, like, oh, you want the best of both worlds, do you? Yes. You want to believe that something might be there, but you're not going to go to church or follow any of its rules. You're like, yeah, I do, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel...
hedge my bets.
And also, having spoken to so many people and had so many stories, which, you know, sometimes you just think, I mean, that's just so weird. Like, stuff happens, you think, that's just so fucking weird. I haven't got a lot, I can't describe that for you. And yeah, like, I definitely, the thing that I found weird after my dad died, I don't know how to explain this, he was definitely still about for a bit. Yeah. Like, in the house, he just was. And my mum, I don't remember this, but my mum says I came home one weekend, went back to the house, and I said, apparently, oh, he's gone. My mum was like, what? I said, he's gone. You can feel it. And then she was like, oh, like something had just shifted. Whether that's us imagining it to make ourselves feel better or the literal presence of a soul or just because my dad was a very, you knew he was in the room is what I always say. Yeah, so he had a big presence. So perhaps I think, you know, you give out that energy and I think walls pick stuff up. Like they just, you know, they're just natural material. That's, I sound really hippie now. I am a hippie. I went to the Wailing Wall when I was a teenager on a school trip. Weird. And I loved being in Israel. It was amazing. And I put my hand on the Wailing Wall. I never told this story. And it buzzed. It like buzzed, this wall. Oh, wow. And I thought, whatever you believe, the fact that, you know, for thousands of years, people have poured their hearts and souls into that wall, it means there's something that, whether scientifically you could say, no, there's nothing here, and or you could be like, yes, this is a holy wall. Like, whatever you believe, there's the fact that human beings have put so much importance on that one object is going to affect it, I believe, in some way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating one that we really, I think, on the kind of, on the atheist front, that people, it's something my brother was teaching me about recently, how in this day and age, we kind of say science is fact and religion is ignoring the facts. And that was never the case originally. A lot of the great scientific things came from a religion. And the point being, science ignores so much that religion tries to address and account for and makes
a sense of.
The easy example my brother gave was numbers.
Yeah, yeah.
There's two of us here. That two doesn't actually exist anywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
It's in our minds. We're both aware of this two. Yeah. It's not a physical thing.
Yeah.
So that isn't addressed in science. Yeah. Or even simply a mathematical equation. The fallibility of maths is explained in, you're aware of infinity is an endless amount of numbers, so two times infinity is the same as infinity, but it can't be because it's two times. So, do you know what I mean? It's just to show that there's certain things that it can't be explained away, and what religion at least tries to do is to try and explain the auras or the feelings or the
mind.
Everything that we do is in our head, and that isn't explainable. If you look in the brain, there's not the thoughts and all that. So there is this key part of all of our existence that isn't explained in science, and that's what religion, I think, tries to do in places. So whilst I think it gets it wrong a lot, and I don't particularly agree with any of the religions, I don't agree that, well, they're all just nonsense and science has got it figured out.
Well, that's how, like, as I keep saying, like, I'm a really, like, I sound like such a moderate, but I always think nothing is simple. Yeah. Nothing is like, you're wrong, I'm right. Nothing is. Yeah. And, you know, having spoken to so many people about death and spoken to people who are end-of-life doulas or palliative care nurses, like, there's some stuff that happens when people die that's a bit strange and isn't explainable. And that I'm okay with that. Like, I'm really okay. I don't, as a person, I know other people, I don't feel the need to go, well, either it's God or it's science. I'm like, who knows? It's just some weird shit. And, like, I've seen, you know, my dad's not the only person I've seen pass away, and I've definitely been in the presence of, it sounds really patronizing again, but like when you see a dead body, that's what I found, that sort of really changed my thinking. So I was like, oh, he's not in that anymore. Yeah. So where is he? What is he? Yeah. What is that? And it, whatever, I sort of always come back, like, whatever works for you, if it gives you comfort, if it gives you comfort to have religion, I absolutely don't judge people for it at all, because I think, how nice to think we're all going to heaven. Lovely. Yeah. Why not? That sounds wonderful.
Completely.
But also, when the other thing that annoys me with that, when they go, oh, well, they all think we're going to heaven, it's easy. It's like, no, but they have to live in this world full of pain and believe that their God is part of that plan. That's really, it's hard to be, to have faith. It's really hard to look around the world and go, okay, this is all for this other reason.
He's got a reason. He's got a reason. He's going somewhere with this. He's going, just hear him out.
Yeah. So I'm definitely not religious in that like traditional sense, but there's a church that we used to go to a lot that my grandpa was really involved in. And he, like, in the city of London, my grandpa worked in the city a lot, and that's where my dad's funeral was. And if I walk past it, I always pop in and light a candle.
Yeah.
And my atheist husband is always a bit like, I now light a candle for his mum and dad as well, and he's always a bit like, I don't know how they'd feel about that. And I say, I know, but for me, it gives me a comfort. Yeah. And I also don't think there's not malicious. I mean, some people feel it's malicious, but to put your religion on something. But I go to that church and I just sit there and I just feel a bit better. But
it's such a catch-22 as well, because if you're right, then they're not going to feel anything about it, because they're not there to feel about it, so it doesn't matter. Yeah. So, but if you're not, then it's this.
And for me, when I light that candle, what I'm doing, and again, that's the thing, I think sometimes we try and put rules or put meaning, but all I'm doing when I light a candle is remembering them, a bit like you're saying with Jay's birthday. Yeah. You're just remembering him, and no one can tell you that's right or wrong to remember someone. Like, that's the way I'm choosing to remember them, in a place where I know that candle's going to stay alight for a bit. And that makes me feel like, and I just take a moment to go, you know, these people that I have lost who are significant and have shaped me and a part of me, to just go, oh, I'm just thinking of you right now. And wherever you are or whoever you are, and even if you're nothing and it's just, you're just disappeared into the sky, I hope you're all right. You know, and I hope I'm all right. And it's just to take that time to go, oh, yeah, that person mattered. And I think, you know...
And that's nice for the living.
Yeah, it's definitely for me. Any. It's an act for me. It's not for my dad.
I think that's the key is...
I'm not worrying about him in that situation.
Exactly. So if you believe it or not, if it's helping that individual and if it's helping other individuals, if it means that we're all getting together and having a chat and having a conversation, then that's the best
situation. We always say in the podcast, like, whatever works for you, as long as it's not causing you or someone else harm or pain. Yeah. Like, that's what you know, because you're right. You can't just be like, well, I feel good drinking whiskey and smashing bottles on people's faces, so I'm going to do it. You're like, well, that other people don't like
it. It's my way of grieving.
Yeah, it's my way of grieving. People do like to trot that out. I'm grieving. But I think, I find that really helpful. And I think, like you said earlier, it's like what works, you know, with mental health, it's like what works for you, it won't work for someone else. But going to that church, and I don't ever make a pilgrimage, it's just sometimes, you know, you're in the city, you think, oh, it's just there. I always make sure I go and pop in and say hello.
I love it.
So I've actually got weirdly a bit more spiritual doing the show, because so many people have said so many things that I've gone, God, it's just, I just don't think it's simple.
There's something there.
But I welcome the atheist to tell me that it's, you know.
Yeah.
But atheism, I think atheism is deeply spiritual. To believe that you're just a body and you degrade back into the earth, that to me sounds deep. I think, wow, like all your nitrogen going back in. I don't see a lack of belief in atheism. I see just a different form of processing.
Again, people fall upon science for atheism. But as I said, the main bit, our personalities, the stuff that's going on, there's no scientific way of logging that, of reading that. It's why we can't read people's minds. It's something that's just there. So we can't scientifically go, well, that bit just stops.
Yeah, yeah.
Because does it? Does that continue on somewhere else?
Exactly.
Chances really are it does just stop. But that there's nothing to... You can't, say that.
It's, well, even when people say to me, oh, the worm food thing, and it's like, well, we cremated my dad and we spread those ashes, and those ashes went into the earth somewhere, and they'll be part of a plant somewhere, and that plant will grow, and, you know, I mean, I'm such a hippie, but, like, I do believe, like, it's not... You literally... And this is the thing that blew my mind at school. You can't destroy energy. Like, it just changes.
Yeah, completely.
So it's just going somewhere else. Whatever, wherever you believe that energy is going, it's going somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I mean... I'm going to move on from Griefcast before we wrap things up. It's become just a big conversation. But you've been in some of my favourite things ever.
I do comedy. I know. It's so bad. Yeah, I talk so much about death.
There's the comedy side of it as well. You do improv and you do comedy. But the ones that I need to get some conversation about.
Yes.
Murder in Successville, I think, is just one of the greatest shows.
Love doing that show.
Ever. Yeah. How was that to be part of? Because the thing that always blew me away about it was... now that it's made, this is the greatest thing ever. I've no idea how this got made because it's such a bonkers idea.
Yeah, I know.
And it's such, it looks so much fun to make and such a laugh that you'd think it's mad that the BBC allowed this to happen and did this. But
it was one of those, like,
such a good show.
As a comedy actor, you get asked to do, you know, lots of read throughs and tasters. And I remember I came in, they did a taster before me, but I came in on one taster, which is like a 15 minute version of it. And I remember them explaining it to me and me thinking, what are they talking about? But they were like,
I should explain this. It's Tom Davis is playing the role of a detective.
D.I. Sleet.
And he has a celebrity partner each time who just doesn't know anything that's going on.
There's been a murder in Successville, the town of Successville, and all the celebrities are actually played by comedians.
Yeah.
And then the real celebrity has to guess, like a murder mystery, who's done it.
Who did the murder mystery.
So the
doctor will be Miley Cyrus, the chief, or the other chief is Gordon Ramsay.
Except
it's not Gordon Ramsay, it's being played by
Liam,
a comedian.
It's Liam doing a great impression.
But then there will be a Deborah Meaden or whoever else who will actually be there as the assistant in trying to solve the murder mystery.
You still have to watch. It's one of those where
it's so weird to explain, isn't it? But that's exactly why I'm like, how did it get made? Because you completely have to watch this for it to make any sense on paper.
Credit to Tom and those producers because they were just absolutely, I think they were, you know, pushing it for a while, just being like, this can work.
It's going to be great.
Based on Tom's, you know, such a funny person and that character he had down so well. So yeah, we did this taster with them. I've forgotten his name, but he was like a massive pop star because he like tweeted a picture of us doing it on the taster. I got like hundreds of girls hatting me going, where is he now? And I was like, who is he? What's happening? But I can't remember. I'm so sorry. I can't remember his name. But yeah, the first time they talked, I just said, well, what do you need me to do? And the first taster, I was Justin Bieber, which we did again in the first series. And they were like, well, we just want you to be Justin Bieber. And I was like, well, can I do it as if I'm like a New York 1930s gangster? And they're like, yeah. I was like, well, great, that's fine. You know, I'm happy to do that.
That's the beauty of it. It's not necessarily always accurate impressions of, it's these weird warped versions of, it's Justin Bieber, but Justin Bieber as, a guy who works in a morgue or whatever else it may be.
The first series was really mad. Like, I've never worked on a show like that when you just really don't know. You're like, what's happening? You're like, what's happening? And and all the celebrities as well.
So much of it is improv as well, because the celebrity, the actual celebrity,
the real celebrity,
hasn't got a script.
They keep them aside as well. Yeah. So we never even see them until they walk onto set and you're dressed as Miley Cyrus.
So you guys have got a rough script and you know the points that you have to hit.
Yeah.
There's going to be improvised bits because you're working with someone who hasn't seen the script.
I should say, like, they have writers and they do a proper script.
Yeah.
But obviously the problem is I remember, like, Deborah Meaden, I was being Cheryl Sanders Cole Vincini, whatever you want to know her as. And we had this scripted bit we were going to get Deborah to do with these sandwiches, and Tom and I were going to do this thing, and we practice it, we rehearse it, we, you know, we're like, oh, and if she does this, we'll do this. And then we got the sandwiches, I'm sitting there as Cheryl, like, I've not we gone, I'm like, we're all ready to do it. That's a terrible Cheryl impression, I haven't done it for ages. All I can, I Cheryl, she goes, I'm so shocked. That's my Cheryl. I can't believe it, I'm so shocked. And her face doesn't change. Did you see her? Who do you think you are? She's like, I'm so shocked. I'm so sad. I can't believe it. I'm so shocked. It was amazing. Anyway, so then Deborah sat down and she just started interrogating me and Tom. Like, actually, was like, how long have you known each other? What's happening? How long have you lived? And we had all this stuff planned. We were going to do sandwiches and we were looking at each other like, it has to go out the window because that's what she's doing. So we had to, like, massively invent this backstory about how we'd been a couple but he'd dumped me and I was upset about it, like, because it was like she was not playing the sandwich game, so you're like, oh, okay. So yeah, there is a very tight, they do, you know, plan, we work out jokes or funny things that happen, and then it just often gets thrown out the window because they decide
wherever it goes,
because they literally walk in the room and they don't know who they're meeting and what's happening, and you know, and then you're dressed, and like Miley Cyrus, it took 3 hours to, I had like fake, I had 2 wigs on, fake bottom and upper and bottom, whatever the word is, teeth, and I was managing an old people's home, and amazing. Like, we had all these old, like, extras playing old people, and Dermot O'Leary just walked in, and you know, it's obviously, it's quite overwhelming, I think, to suddenly be faced with Miley Cyrus shouting at you, but yeah, I loved doing that show because they really let you have a lot of fun. And it was, but the first series I really enjoyed because none of the celebrities really knew. Obviously, the second series, you know, people have seen the show, but that first series.
Or Jamie Lang, the first episode ever was my favourite. Jamie Lang. That's the best episode, or one of the best episodes of any comedy I've ever seen, because it's just.
So I was Darcy Bustle in that one.
Yes.
Basically being Audrey Hepburn. Darcy's quite hard to impersonate because she's quite sort of like normal.
Yeah.
And then after the cameras stopped, he carried on questioning me. He was like, but where were you? And where have these euros come from? And I was like, oh, darling, I couldn't possibly tell you. And I was like looking at Tom like, what's happening? Have we? Because I'd said cut. And I was like, should I? Because they want to be right. They want to solve it. So he was like trying to get more clues. And I was like, then he was like, what's that in your bag? And obviously the costume people had just put crap in my bag. Like there's nothing. And he was like, oh, I see you've got some euros and you've got like a mirror. And I was like, oh, I didn't even know that was in there. The costume lady didn't even know it was in there. It's just an old bag. They shoved it in front of me. So they get quite into trying to solve it.
Yeah.
Some of them do anyway. But yeah, I loved doing that show. It was so much fun.
So going from something that you're probably looking at and going, what the hell is this? Is this even going to make it to air? Anyone going to care about this? The other one I need to get into talking about is the recent... this time with Alan Partridge, then jumping onto, I mean, Alan is one of the greatest comedy creations ever, of all time. Yeah. And I thought this return was perfect. I was stunned when I saw so many people being, oh, I'll wait and see. It's probably going to be crap. I was
what?
Like, it was like his Mid-Morning Matters stuff, which
so
I guess
good.
A lot of people didn't see because it was on Sky or whatever.
There
so
was some on YouTube before the Sky ones, which was so
on Facebook as well, wasn't it? Originally was the first ones, I think.
They were so funny.
And they were just as good as anything he's ever done. So I was excited, but it was beautiful to see. Because again, I was tweeting about it saying, I can't wait for this. And a few people were like, I don't know, maybe they should leave it alone and all that. And I was, again, if you've not had... The Mid-Morning Matters to know that it's...
To know that, also to know from Knowing Me,
Brothers.
Knowing You.
Yeah.
Like, Knowing Me, Knowing You, if he'd stopped there, you wouldn't have got the other Alan, you know, the other series that most people know, I'm Alan Partridge. You go, well, they managed it with Knowing Me, Knowing You, taking that character and completely moving him and aging him and turning it into this... So of course they can keep doing it. That was incredible.
So how was that to work on?
Oh, my God, I felt like a fan.
Yeah.
I'm a comedy... fan. That's why I do comedy. So the same thing when I did Peep Show and when I did Alan Partridge, you just feel like you've won a competition. I felt like I was entered a smash hits competition, and I was like lucky enough to be sat there, and I was waiting for someone to be like, and you have to go now because now the proper people are going to do the thing. Carry on. Like
it's all
just
finished.
And it's, you know, it's Steve Coogan sitting there as Alan, being Alan in front of you. Do you know what? It's one of the funnest days filming because I just was like, I don't care. I've won. I don't care. I don't care what happens. I get to sit next to him as he's doing it and watch the process, which was just so good. Like, the detail, the refinement that him and, the Gibbons brothers, have on it. You know, the intensity and like, just obviously someone who writes comedy, to see experts writing it was just like, it was like a little workshop. I just sat there trying to take it all in and think, oh my God, okay, that's what he's doing. That, and watching him, you know, especially because you're watching him do one take and then go, I'm going to, you know, he untouched my tie differently. And you could see the all of it building up. I just felt lucky. I just felt so lucky. And it was such a nice, the Alice Fluck was like, it was such a good character. It was so fun. And I know I'd worked with Susanna Fielding before.
Such a good character as well, because it just had, it's one of the best bits of his, of Alan's tongue-tied moment, things like that were just...
Oh, I see what I've done there.
So simple.
I also got to see, which I feel sad for people who didn't, the original script was much longer, and there were so many jokes that they would just drop. They'd be like, oh, drop it because this is, you know, they have a wealth of jokes.
Yeah.
And like they were dropping jokes. I was like, if I'd written that, I'd have it framed. Like, that is the best thing that's ever happened. But they've got so many, like, oh, well, we can lose those three and put that one in. You'd be like, oh, my God. Like, no one even knows there was all this joke here.
Yeah.
That they didn't even make it. That's so funny. So, yeah, the audition script was longer. And then, you know, we filmed quite a lot and then it got cut down. And you were like, yeah, I just, honestly, I couldn't have been, I felt, I just, and you're sat on the sofa just watching him. It was wonderful. I just felt so happy. And yeah, Susanna, who I did another sitcom with her, and I just thought she was amazing as well.
Yeah,
so her timing and sitting next to Steve Coogan, you know, like you said, he's just a legend, isn't he, in terms of our world of comedy. And you think, I thought she was so good with him.
It's the one when I was catching up with my brother. He was saying the complete unsung hero
it
was such a good understated performance of everything, and just
and holding him together, completely holding that performance. Yeah. Like, you had to have Susanna for that, with 100%. Him to work. Yeah. So, yeah, I would just, some jobs, I don't know if you have this, you just feel really lucky. And I've
only moved into acting in the last 3-4 years, and literally every job I've had, I've been like, this is the best. This is so, I've got that excited childish,
yeah,
like,
yeah, it's nice.
To the party, whereas everyone's sitting around jaded and miserable. And I'm like, I've got a film set.
Yeah, yeah. I still feel
how
like
cool
that.
Is this?
I don't feel like that with gigs so much, because I think I've definitely, once you've gigged for a long time,
that's what
you're
you get to know so well. Well, yeah. The final thing is, it's interesting because Murder and Successful, I mean, we've not talked about Ostentatious and Improv,
I should plug Ostentatious.
Your experience in that will have helped you and equipped you for Murder and Successful
because of the improvisation nature
of it. But I don't think I've had anyone on who was on one of my favourite shows. It's a weird one to bring up because it's a show that's just been around a while, but I love Would I Lie to You. I think it's just so much fun. I think it's genuinely Bride and Mitchell and Lee Mack are always just hilarious on it. But I was thinking about it, do you feel your improv experience helped you in that situation, in that show, because you are having to improvise? You read out your either truth or lie, and then you're having to be interrogated again, similar to Jamie Lang in Murder and Successful.
People start interrogating me. I get interrogated a lot. I think I have done panel shows. I wouldn't claim to be, you know, some stand-ups who are so amazing at them.
You've done the best ones, though. QI and Hypothetical are three of my absolute favourites just really
good. I loved Hypothetical. That was so fun. That was really, they really let you improvise on that.
Yeah.
But I think I would say to anybody, I mean, not all comedians do improv, obviously. It's much bigger in America, but it's getting bigger here. And I think every job I've had, the improv has come in handy. Like, what I love about it is, you know, so much of acting and television and comedy filming stuff just changes in front of your face.
Completely.
And what I love is I never panic. So that, like, Alan Partridge, they were, you know, changing stuff literally before the camera rolled.
Yeah.
And the ability to just be like, okay with that. Not to say I'm great, my performance would be great, but just to not be like, fucking hell, shit, I can't do it. And I know actors.
I've learned my lines and now
they're all gone. Yeah. And I think comedy is a really good place for actors who don't mind things changing and evolving, because I think the nice thing about when you do comedy filming is people go, oh, you know what, it's funnier if this happens, it's funnier if that. It's different in a drama, of course, sometimes it's structurally you can't change things, and I think that's what I love about improv, is that you just go, okay, I know it'll be fine if they just suddenly change your costume, your hair, what you're saying, where you're standing, the character name, it's like, yeah, it'll be fine. And the panel shows, it definitely, I mean, it still makes you nervous going on those things, especially like Would I Lie to You? Like, God, you know, those are some very, very funny people.
Yeah.
And I've loved Rob Brydon since he did Marion and Jeff. Like,
I think it's the best show the BBC has ever made, Marion and Jeff. I just think because it's got a darkness and a sadness.
So good.
That, like, generally I'll watch it and it'll bring tears to my eyes because it's just so beautifully done.
Human Remains, the one he did with Julia Davis.
Yes,
that.
Also fantastic.
Oh, God, I love that show. Yeah, and Rob has a very special place in my heart because I wrote to him when I was nobody and sent him a sketch that I did, and he gave me a quote for my Edinburgh poster.
Oh, wow.
Years, like, this is, what yeah. And then, like, posted my sketch and stuff. And so I've always, you know, and you have, like, you were kind.
Yeah.
When I really needed it.
And you didn't need to be.
So, yeah, I'm always a bit funny with that, Rob. I always feel like it's a bit of, like, I want him to be my uncle, but I don't know if he wants that. So I feel like, I just, those shows, if the more relaxed you can be, the better, because stuff happens that is not planned. So yeah, Would I Lie to You especially. But even like Have I Got News for You, you know, QI, like it's, I actually, when I do them, I don't like to be told anything, preferably, because I'm better that way. I just react better that way. Especially with like QI, you're like, just don't, I'll start worrying about, should I really research shrews?
I can't know everything, I may as well not.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But the improv, having done it for over 10 years, and we've been doing Ostentatious now for 8 years, so it's like that regular improv. It just means your brain is very relaxed when things are changing in front of you, which I think is quite a good human skill, hopefully.
Completely. Well, I'll wrap things up now by kind of, let's just talk a little bit now about how how you approached bringing Griefcast, which is such an intimate and personal conversation, to a live
a
scenario. Because when I've done this podcast live, but I always do it as the crowd or the guest. So people just come up one at a time.
Oh, nice.
And they come up and sit down. And the reason for that is the point of them is that they're meant to be these intimate conversations, not a performance. Yeah. As soon as there's a crowd there, you're going to be giving your, and here's my anecdote about the time I met Stephen Fry. and go on. So I've never done them live, but you kind of found a way to make Griefcast work live by having kind of multiple guests on often and things like that. What was your thought and approach on that?
Yeah, well, there's a really good comedy festival called MacFest in Wales, Mahundith. And I used to do my solo shows there. And one year, Henry, who runs it, was like, oh, do you want to do Griefcast? And I was like, yep. And then I thought, the fuck am I going to do Griefcast? Which is how all, Pip, like, that's how all my decisions are. It's like me, I say, yep. And then I think, oh, shit. So that was, and then obviously there's like a load of comedians there. And I thought, well, I can't do one-on-one because the whole point of Griefcast is intimate, it's personal, it's closed, in the room is closed, there's not an audience present. So I thought, well, I can't do one-on-one, no one will open up. And then I thought, oh, well, I'll just get three comedians and figure it out, because I'm an improviser. Just beforehand, I bought some cakes and I had a cup of tea and I thought, well, I'll just ask them. And the first one was Nish Kumar, Kiri Pritchard-McLean and Phil Wang. Yeah, so
great,
I mean,
lineup.
MacFest, they're all there. They're all there and they've got an hour free.
Yeah.
And the nice thing, I think, because I used to do a lot of devised theatre as well, so I don't mind things being a bit ropey at first and then you think, oh, this is what we need to learn from. So the first one wasn't ropey, but I've definitely got a bit tighter format now. But what we just talked about was just how they felt about death, and then we sort of loosely planned their funerals. But I've done quite a few now live ones, and I think because I'm a live performer, I wanted to have a place where I could do it because I missed, you know, I like being on stage.
Yeah.
So I was like, come on, there must be a way to do this and get a crowd in and have a night for people who are grieving that's kind of positive.
Yeah.
So they're in a room where we all talk about death, but it's often very, very funny. And they're with people around them who are interested in that subject. So they don't feel alone. They don't feel weird. And they often speak to people and be like, oh, yeah, me too. You know, everyone sort of finds their, oh, yeah, oh, your dead mum club. Yeah, me too. And I was like, oh, I want to have that community, to have a night out. I feel like we deserve a night out. So I did work hard to try and make it, to think about how it would be. And I always say to the comedians, I also really book, it's really comedians for that one. It's also a nice way if someone says to me, people often say to me, I want to do it, but I haven't got, no one's died. And I think, well, someone must have died. But they say, I haven't got a story. So if they haven't got a big story, it means they can come and do the live show.
Yeah.
And then everyone has an answer to what do you want for your funeral?
Yeah, yeah.
Even, you know, if they don't have an answer, they can have a conversation about it. So we basically, like, what do you want your funeral to be? And, like, then, you know, you get, where do you want to be buried or cremated? And you get into these insane, because people say stuff like, oh, by this tennis court. And everyone's like, what? What do you mean by that's noisy? The ball will hit you. Like, everyone's got opinions on everything. And I was lucky enough to go to...
And it's okay to have these opinions before it's happened.
Yeah, exactly.
If it's after it's happened, people are like, exactly. I didn't want to say anything, but really, that was a terrible choice.
And that's what I love so much is it starts off really funny. And about three quarters of the way in, they suddenly realise... Actually, how do I want to be remembered?
Yeah.
And so you end, I say to everyone, I'm like, it'll be really stupid and silly. And then suddenly you'll end up, one of you will be like, you know what, actually, guys, we really need to think about this.
Yeah.
And there's always this moment where you're like, oh, that's so profound, what they just said. And they've just been joking about it for like 20 minutes. But I always say in the show, like sometimes I ask a comedian, what do you want? They're like, oh, I've never thought about it. Or they go, nothing. I don't care. Put me out with the bins. And then like we always have to say, somebody's going to have to make that decision.
Yeah.
So are you willing to put that on your family, that they have to decide for you? Yeah. And then they're like, oh, I don't know. Like, well, do you want your friends to decide? And
they're not going to want to put you out by the
bins. Exactly. And they're like, well, I don't care. It doesn't matter. It's like, no, it doesn't matter to you, but it will matter to someone. So do you want to put on record on this podcast that you want your family to make every decision? And then they start going, oh, no, I don't want to go by those bins. No, I'd like a tree. And you're like, say it now so that people know.
Because
that's my big thing is people just don't talk about it. And then it comes to a funeral and everyone's like, oh, fuck, what was that song they liked?
Yeah.
You know, like there's a song you might have jokingly said you liked 10 years ago and everyone's like, no, he told me he wanted it at his funeral.
Yeah.
But no, I'm overriding it. Like, you know, So Solid Crew is definitely what Pip's after.
And my mum's regularly updating her funeral playlist and what she wants and stuff like that.
I think
there's
it's
songs that get taken off and
put
on.
You change your opinion.
You should do,
yeah. Yeah, so the live one
it
is.
It shouldn't be a morbid thing either. It should be a fun. That's a fun conversation to have.
It's really fun.
Because you can say it, then someone will say, how about that So Solid Crew song?
You go,
oh my God, that's so good. Imagine how weird that will be.
Yeah. They had a really, somebody, I can't remember who it was now, said they would get some of their friends in on a joke to stand up during the funeral and shout, this isn't what they wanted, but only some of their friends. And then they also said they would tell one friend to plan everything wrong, like the wrong, although it was Josie Long, and we haven't put this episode, she was like, she wanted to have like branded coffin, like Amazon stickers, Facebook, and like, but to someone to be in on it, but the rest of them be like, oh my God, who planned this? This is not this what she would have wanted. And then being like, no, she requested it. Yeah. And she said the whole congregation being like, we didn't know her, did we? Yeah. We didn't know. Some of that's so nice, like, you know,
it's brilliant.
And now I went to Sweden, did a live one there as well at the Stockholm Podcast Festival.
How was that?
Yeah, fascinating, because they are worse than we are.
Who knew?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I was like, no, we're the worst. And they were like, no, we are. And the way they talked about it, they do not talk about it.
Wow.
The thing that I loved, so, you know, we say, if I told you now, oh, my so-and-so died, you might say, oh, I'm so sorry for your loss. Like, everyone knows it doesn't, like, it doesn't weigh that much, but at least it's something to say. Yeah. Swedish language doesn't have a phrase.
Wow.
So they have one phrase that's really old-fashioned, and this lady, Annika Lantz, who's like amazing, like a radio legend in Sweden, she was like, she said, I can't even say it in my mouth. It would be like the equivalent of me, but like, you know, my dearest fellow of old time that I have known, let me know my sorrow passes to your heart. Like, it would be really weird.
Yeah.
So they don't even have a phrase. So she said they just don't say anything. She said if someone says anything, you're like, all right. Like, you don't know what, there's no.
Wow.
And I was like, I'm so sorry for my loss. Take it.
Yeah.
It's fine.
You can use that.
It's all right. It does the job.
Yeah.
It's not great, but at least
it's acknowledging.
Yeah.
It.
But yeah, Swedish, they are, yeah, they were like, we do not talk about it. It's really, like, uncomfortable for us to even sit here.
I think we've more than made up for it in today's chat. So there's that as
sorry,
well.
Sorry, much death.
Thank you very much for coming on. Is there anything you want to plug or tell people about?
Oh, well, we've talked about the Griefcast a lot. So, yeah, download the Griefcast and it's not as depressing. It's cheerier than it sounds. And then, just Ostentatious is touring and in Edinburgh and in the West End. So go to ostentatiousimpro.com or, you can find me on Instagram. That's mainly where I live.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Carrie Ed. How wonderful she is. I loved speaking to her because she's someone like myself who kind of speaks on subjects that we're regularly told are morbid, but we maybe didn't realise were morbid until people kept telling us they were morbid. But that's why they're important to talk about, because we don't talk about death and all these taboo subjects. Anyway, it's the outro now, and as you may know, I'm now doing longer outros than intros, so people who want to can get straight into the meat of the podcast, and people who want to hear more about what's been going on can tune in now. So I'll let you know that we had the club night at the weekend. We Are Lizards at the Book Club. It was one of the busiest ones we've ever done, and it also happened to be one of the hottest ones we've ever done. As you know, it's been warm of late, so imagine that in a basement with 300-400 sweaty people. I also debuted a new lizard mask. A lot of you know I DJ in traditionally a rubber lizard mask. This one was a new fabric lizard mask, which I enjoyed. So that was good. I should also mention, it said Pod Bible comes out on Monday. I'm so excited about this. I know I don't mention it constantly because I don't want to overwhelm you with it. But if you can give it a look, I'd really appreciate it, because me, Adam Richardson and Stu Whiffin are putting in so much work on this, and it's going so ridiculously well. We're really proud of it. It's only the three of us working on it, and so far, like, we're now partnered up with Acast, Spotify, Global, Audible, BBC, just all these huge people, Pixiu, just loads of amazing, huge established companies all getting on board. We have this weird little idea that me and Stu and Adam have put together. And it's a podcast magazine. So recommending podcasts, interviewing podcasters, giving you information and backstories and all sorts of stuff like that. And it's free. You can get physical copies. We'll be handing them out in Brighton on Monday, in London on Tuesday, and I'll be handing them out in Edinburgh on Thursday and Friday, all of next week. So it's just something that we're putting a hell of a lot of time and effort in. So I'm really proud of it. And yeah, I'd love you all to give it a look. But I don't think there's too much else to tell. Oh, no, there is. There's Epic Beard Men. So as you hear this, the Epic Beard Men tour has started. You will have heard them on the podcast previously. I've had Sage Francis on and B. Dolan on separately. And then I had them on together last time they were over. This is looking like being the last time they're over for a while. So, yeah, I highly recommend you check them out. They're on the 30th of July, which was yesterday, as you hear this, they're in Southampton. They're in London at the Jazz Cafe on the 31st of July. So just go there tonight, man. You won't regret it. August 1st, they're in Leicester. August 2nd, they're in Nottingham. August 3rd, they're in Bristol. August 4th, they're in Birmingham. August 5th, they're off. August 6th, they're in Guildford. 7th, Brighton. 9th, Glasgow. 10th, Edinburgh. 11th, Newcastle. 13th, Leeds. And 14th, Manchester. I'll be popping along to one or two of them. Dan Lesak will be popping along to one or two of them. You never know who's going to be in and about. So, yeah. Go and check out the Epic Beard Man. I promise you, you won't regret it. It's the best live rap show currently doing the rounds. That's all I have to tell you, I think. Next week's guest is Matt Richardson. We talk about gaming and wrestling, essentially, and a bit of UFC, maybe even a bit of CrossFit. But it's a really good chat because we talk about his story and his journey, because he was a wrestler and then he decided to stop wrestling just before British wrestling became the biggest thing in the world. And he genuinely has no regrets over that. And it's a fascinating conversation. So that'll be next week. Yeah. So until then, thank you for tuning in. Obviously, Patreon, that's a thing. Patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. I've got all my stuff over there. It's Poem of the Month on Monday. So that'll be cool. And then there's Distraction Pieces, Rewind episodes, all sorts of stuff like that. So head over to Patreon.com/ScroobiusPip if you fancy spending a quid on that. Yes. Other than that, I will see you all next week. Ta-ta!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.